Socialism is garbage. Capitalism plus democracy is the best operating system humanity has ever come out with. When you and I look at this, capitalism, democracy, as Americans, we go, well, of course you want to live in the country that is at war with itself, is fighting, it's messy, it's sloppy. This election, the last election, the election before that, and every election before that, it's a mess here. It feels crazy. But the economy keeps beating everything else out there. Why? Because we believe in the fundamental tenet of competition, and that running from competition is a mistake, and running towards competition is great. If you want to have big outcomes, you need to support crazy, vibrant competition.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Gusto. Gusto is easy online payroll, benefits, and HR built for modern small businesses. Get 3 months free when you run your first payroll at gusto.com/twist. Fundrise. Fundrise provides access to diversified portfolios of private real estate to all investors with their industry-leading, easy-to-use platform. Sign up today at fundrise.com/twist. And DevSquad. Most dev agencies only offer developers. Why? Because product management is hard. Get an entire product team for the cost of one U.S. developer plus 10% off at devsquad.com/twist.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm Jason Calacanis. He's Alex Wilhelm. We do this 3 days a week, but this week, I think we're doing four shows.
We are doing four shows.
It's just going to be three. I promise you, Alex. I hired you for three shows a week, 150 shows a year. Next week or next year, three shows a week. And hey, if we sell out, I don't think I'm adding the fourth show.
Jason, before we get into our guests and the rundown, I do want to jump on some breaking news, which is...
Breaking news?
Yes, breaking news. As of like roughly 29 minutes ago, as of right now, the upcoming president has announced that Paul Atkins is going to be the next chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, aka the SEC. I don't think anyone really thought that Gary Gensler was going to get more time in the chair. So not a huge shock, but I do know that Paul is a person that the crypto community is going to love.
Okay. I see this is breaking. This has all happened, like Alex says, in the last couple of minutes. I actually have never heard of this person. So I'm just pulling up a CNBC breaking news story here. So here we go. Paul Atkins, founder and chief executive of Potomac Global Partners, LLC. Don't know what that is. Speaks during a Bloomberg television interview at the Milken Institute, which has about 17,000 speakers, in May of 2017. All right. Currently, he's the CEO of Potomac Global Partners. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
Critically, Jason, he was a former SEC commissioner during the Bush W era, so 2002 through 2008. You know, I think he's a crypto guy. I think that's his background in nature. So I think this is Trump making good on his promise to the Bitcoin folks and so forth who threw their support behind him. So if you were in favor of more stringent crypto regulation, you're not going to get it. And if you wanted less of that, well, good news for you. This appears to be your guy. So
what did Trump say? Let's read the Trump quote. If you can use your best Trump voice, that would always be appreciated. No, you don't have
I've actually never tried to do a Trump impersonation, so I'll pass. But he did say that he's the... Do you got to do a lot of this? I don't know. I can't do it. I wish he was doing more of this, holding on to bars, but he's not. All right, here we go. I am delighted to announce the nomination of Paul Atkins.
Here we go. I'm delighted to... announce the nomination of Paul Atkins to be the next chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Paul is a proven leader for common sense regulations. He believes in the promise of robust, innovative capital markets that are responsive to the needs of investors. I can't do it. And that provide capital to make our economy, capital E, interesting, the best in the world, capital W. Okay. He also recognizes that digital assets and other innovations are crucial to making America greater than ever before. Ooh, it's not MAGA. It's Megeb. It's yes. Megeb this time. Okay, well, there you have it, folks. The nominations are coming in fast and furious. We should think about taking Trump seriously, not literally, is the famous quote that Peter Thiel quotes that somebody else said. Okay, so he said, He was going to create a national Bitcoin trust. He was never going to sell Bitcoin. He was going to fire Gary Gensler. And then he was going to allow more innovation in the space. So if we took him literally, he didn't have to fire Gary. Gary Gensler resigned, right? So that happened, literally. We'll see about the reserve, building a Bitcoin reserve. I believe he wouldn't sell. Why would you sell the Bitcoin? It's that we don't need the money. It's only 400,000 coins. Yeah. I mean, you have to ask yourself, like, is it going to grow more than 6% a year or whatever our interest rate is on our debt? You would think that asset is going to grow more than 6% a year.
Well, if you're Michael Saylor, you certainly do.
You think it's 60? Yeah. So, I mean, between 6 and 60 is a big number. So anyway, if you think it's 6%, you keep it. And then here we go. New leadership. I'm excited about it. I felt Gary Gensler did a great job on prosecuting and going after people who are criminals. Mm-hmm. I think he did a bad job of expanding and clearly explaining a roadmap for these new innovations. So, you know, we'll see. But, you know, the mandate is to execute the laws in the previous administration. I think this administration wants to evolve the laws. So that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this actually plays out, how much progress they can make. But Jason, I just checked, and in the last hour, Bitcoin has moved basically not at all. So I believe in the words of market folks, this was priced in, even if it's still good news to the crypto fans.
I think it is priced in. And then the second thing is there was a shooting.
Yes.
We should just at least mention that here at the top of the program. United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. And I guess United Healthcare's insurance group, mm-hmm. I guess there's other people in this, fatally shot in New York in a targeted attack. If you pull up the Drudge report, they have actually a picture of the guy. And there was just a press conference. NYPD is asking for people to help find this person. Suspect is described as using a firearm with a silencer. And there it is, folks. Zoom in on that. Let's do a little speculation. This happened at 6:45 in the morning at a public event for United Health's shareholders. It was a shareholder meeting. So it was known he was going to be there. Therefore, this was planned. This happened at 6:45. This person is dressed like an assassin, you know, prepared to, you know, be on camera. And he had an escape path. He had an escape route on a city bike. That seems like a really, that to me means amateur, but the silencer says professional. So this is kind of a mixed bag here, based on my knowledge of, you know, mob hits and other type of hits, but this is kind of crazy. Any thoughts? I mean, speculating is kind of meaningless here, but there is an all points bulletin of like, hey, watch out for this guy, because he can't get off the island of Manhattan pretty easily because they can lock it down. I don't know if they've locked down the bridges and gotten people on the platforms in every train leaving and buses leaving, cars leaving, but...
The takeaway that I have here is that I think we're going to see a rapid increase in corporate security budgets.
Ah, yes.
And I think that the era in which CEOs of companies of any sort of note are walking around and getting bagels or whatever you do as a normal person are probably behind us, because, you know, if this had been, and I'm going to try to get the language right here, everyone just give me a little space. If this had been a tragic, random shooting, I think it would have the same amount of pain, but not the same implications for security.
Of course. Yes. That's a great insight, actually, and handled well. The week before in New York, or 2 weeks ago in New York, we had this person who was obviously mentally ill, who was in their 50s with a knife, stab and kill, I think, three people, going from Penn Station to Grand Central or something, just like went on a stabbing spree and killed three people. That one is easier to reconcile because it's random. Still as horrific, somebody dying, but you can actually process it and make a plan for it. You're right here. Like, now, in these situations, just looking statistically, you have to think there are a small subset of possibilities they're going to look at. I asked ChatGPT, hey, tell me about CEOs actually getting trust. Pretty interesting. It's almost universally, there is a layoff at a company, or somebody feels despondent at a company, they've been mistreated, there's some conflict at work, and the person goes postal. That's where the term comes from. going postal. This postal worker at some point went crazy and shot up the post office. So that's a possibility. Then, of course, there's like lover's triangle, all kinds of other things, gambling. You know, that's the long tail of crazy things that happened when I did my research. But my Lord, how terrible. And they said the person started shooting him from 20 feet away, hit him 3 times, and even did like one shot while he was down. So that means they wanted him dead and they wanted to make an example of him in some way or a spectacle of it. Or the person didn't get their healthcare coverage, had a loved one who didn't. You know, there's that possibility angle. I see a bunch of speculation about online as well. So
yeah, well, in this country where we do have several hundred million guns, and just to be clear, I got my first gun when I was 12. So, you know, I'm one of the people who has them or had. I don't in my current town, but I did it in rural Oregon where I grew up. You're not going to be able to have a gun-free environment pretty much anywhere unless you're screening every single person, and you can't do that on the street. So I think that's why we're going to see a arming of corporate America to protect their principles. So a tragedy and a mess and a very sad story.
You don't like guns? This ain't the country for you, because it's number 2 in the rules. Freedom of speech. If you don't like words, you don't like guns, might I suggest picking another country? England, Australia, there are plenty of countries that don't have any guns or almost no guns. And they have different views of, you know, freedom of speech and slander, right? Like, so.
Or you can move to the Northeast where you can't have guns and you have free speech. Hey, there you go.
Well, you know, you do have, that's a very interesting thing. You know, when I lived in New York, you, as a New York City resident, you felt like there were no guns. And right. Then you went upstate New York to the Catskills or whatever, and people had guns over their fireplaces. And you had this like juxtaposition, what's going on here? But no handguns in Manhattan, you're correct. Or in San Francisco, unless you're a famous person. And I remember like Howard Stern and some other famous people were given in New York, the under 100, I believe it was, carry permits were given to people who were basically celebrities or had donated. That was some scandal back when I was a kid. All right. You didn't start your company to run payroll, did you? Of course not. We all know that. Gusto is here to help. Gusto is going to help you run your payroll and handle all your benefits, onboarding, and HR all in one place. The market agrees. 300,000 businesses trust Gusto today, and you can too. As your startup scales, Gusto is going to grow with you. You got state and federal taxes handled for your staff around the country. Gusto does all that. And hey, maybe it's finally time for you to offer a 401k plan for your team, right? Gusto's got you on that. And you might need to get your compliance sorted, right? Well, 3 out of 4 employers say Gusto helps them be government compliant. And even better, Gusto is simple, easy to use software. So you can focus on what matters, building your startup. So here's your quick call to action. Do you want all Gusto has to offer with no hidden fees? Well, how about a discount? Try Gusto and get 3 months free. Gusto.com/twist. That's GUSTO.com/twist.
Also hailing from upstate New York. No, it's not a guy with a gun over his mantelpiece, though he might. It's Mike Sherbakov from the Veteran Fund and Herbert Dwyer, the CEO of Impact. Actually, Herbert's the one who lives in upstate New York. I kind of butchered that. But Jason, these are our guests for today.
I'm so excited.
Mike Sherbakov from the Veteran Fund just closed their first fund, $21 million. That was announced 3 weeks ago. That was the final close. And we also have Herbert Dwyer, the CEO of Impact, E-M-P-E-Q, which just won $100,000, Jason, in the veteran pitch competition that I do believe someone we know took part in.
Ah, yes. You know, welcome to the program, Mike and Herbert. Great to have you here. I know Mike, and he invited me to come. And, you know, anytime there's any veteran event, I try to say yes. Like, it's kind of the top of my list of things to say yes to. Why? Well, I got a family full of law enforcement. I know how hard the job is. And listen, I didn't have to serve. And so I always think, gosh, so much of my success in life and so much, think about how much your success as an American is related to the fact that we have a volunteer military that goes out there and defends this country, and not only our country, democracy around the world. And so Mike and Herbert, just right off the bat, Alex and I thank you for your service. And I know that's like a trite thing to say, or maybe people say it all the time, like as a functory thing that they have to say. I actually sincerely think about this all the time. Like, gosh, I really do appreciate that, the sacrifice. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your service each and coming on the program.
Yeah, thanks so much, J.Cal. And on behalf of the Veteran Fund and the veteran community, thank you for everything you do. I think I remember at Founder X, you stood up and said that same thing, where you'll do anything for veterans, and you shared kind of your support, and it means a lot to us. So thank you for being a judge for the pitch comp, and you've been incredibly supportive. I'm happy to kick it off. And, you know, similar to what you just shared, Jason, first generation immigrant to this country, and ended up...
You're first generation. Okay, there it is.
Yeah. Grew up in the Bay Area and joined the Marines at 18 years old. So post 9/11, kind of peak of the war, June 2003, when we first went into Fallujah. And I felt like I had a duty to serve this country. And I saw what this country provided for my family, what it would provide for me later in entrepreneurship as a founder and now as an investor. And I really felt like it was my duty to kind of protect that way of life. And so served in the Marines, came back, ended up going to school, did the whole startup founder thing, had some wins in that world, and then realized that if there's an archetype of founder to invest in, you talk about this all the time, right? The three things investors look for is team, product, market. You could say product velocity as well. But if we're investing in the earliest stages, why not invest in the founder archetype of a military veteran, of someone who's gone through what we consider the world's greatest leadership academy, that's going to run through walls, that is so mission focused. So we end up, we had this idea for the firm 3 years ago. Happy to say that initially it was a proof of concept. We tried to go out and raise $10 million. We ended up closing over double at $21 million. And amazing. Companies like Herbert's and others, we do space, cyber, defense, everything. Our portfolio companies are absolutely crushing it, largely because they have these incredible military veterans on the leadership team that are going to go out and make it happen.
Awesome. And I just showed on the screen some of the portfolio companies. But Mike, if you had to pick your favorite child that's not Impact, who's growing the fastest? Who's the name that we need to have on the show next week? Like, who's the superstar? Come on.
Look, they're all amazing. You love all your babies, of course. I'll tell you that the two crazy breakouts right now that you absolutely need to have on the show. Well, you already had Vatten on. You had Nelson Mills on the team. So the underwater submersibles, incredible technology. What they're doing in submersibles, we have Dan Magee and Chad McCoy, who are doing for Firestorm. Unmanned aerial systems, agnostic payload systems. You can do ISR, you can do kinetic. Incredible technology. We did their pre-seed and seed. They just closed a Series A. They're absolutely crushing it. Got a big $100 million contract. Another one that I think you'll find fascinating is a company called Lone Star Lunar that landed on the moon earlier this year, February of this year, and is going back to the moon. So, Jason, I know you're a big fan, obviously, Elon and SpaceX and all that. I'm going to go to my first space launch next year with the team because we're going back. So, again, space, cyber, defense, these are all investments that matter. One last thing I'll say is it's myself and three incredible partners, Ryan Micheletti, who Jason, you know as well, Justin Nahama, Lisa Song Sutton. All four of us had reached this point in our careers where I would say we'd had successful careers, and it was this time to think about what's next. What are the things that we care about most? And if we're going to put time, energy, and capital, what do we care about? And I say, these are investments that matter. Our tagline is advancing America through venture capital. So, this is the stuff I wake up thinking about. I go to sleep thinking about. It's what I'll do for the next few decades. And so just grateful to be doing this. And thanks for your support.
Awesome. The one question I have for you about the archetypes, and then we'll get to Herbert and you're a great company that won the competition. There are things that you mentioned like, discipline, focus, running through walls, leadership, all great, recruitment. But is there a weakness, perhaps, in that founders sometimes are rule breakers? And they need to do things that maybe are on the margins a little aggressive or improvised. So give me the straight dope, because I'm using the word improvised in a very specific way, because I've done a little research on the military. I always thought I would have been good in a CIA type, on the ground role. I was going to go into the FBI. I was like, there's a lot of improvisation that occurs, dare I say, rule breaking, bending in the field that maybe doesn't get reported on. So maybe tell me about that piece of the puzzle. I'm just curious.
Yeah. What I'll say is, in the Marines, we have a tagline, which is adapt and overcome. And so I also think, you know, to be a good leader, you have to be a good follower first. So there is something to be said about that progression of when you start, you're kind of at the bottom of the totem pole and you have to learn to be a good follower. You have to understand, I know you're big on checklists and SOPs and understanding that whole thing. Then eventually you kind of, you know, earn your way up to this point where now you can start to be a little more flexible. You can break some of those rules. And in the Marines, we understand nothing ever goes perfectly according to plan, but you have to have contingency plans. You have to understand how to adapt and overcome. So to your point, Jason, in addition to the leadership, resilience, and purpose that these veterans have, they also have this incredible adaptability and coachability that we look for in any great founder.
Got it. All right, Herbert, maybe tell us a little bit about the company. You can give us a little pitch here if you like. You can run us through it, however you want to tee it up here, but tell us a little bit about the company and your mission.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here. And, you know, one more term I'll add that we use in the Marine Corps. So everybody is typically familiar with Semper Fidelis or Semper Fi, right? Always faithful. We have Semper Gumby, right? Fastened after our favorite little green friend, which means always flexible. And that is literally, you know,
Semper Gumby.
Semper Gumby.
Always flexible. I love it.
It's a thing. Ask any Marine, they'll tell you. And because it's part of our culture and our ethos to, we are rigid. We are the Marine Corps. However, we also understand that we always have to be flexible because the battle is always changing, right? And what worked yesterday is probably not going to work right now in this current situation, right? Mm-hmm. So it is important. And that kind of thing Marines take into being founders. I've taken that into my company. It's installed in my culture and the people that work on my team. We're Semper Gumby. It's mm-hmm. important.
There you go. Love it.
But with that being said, you know, really honored to win the pitch competition. There were so many incredible, thank you, Alex. There's so many incredible men and women, veterans that just had, I mean, 200 of them, over 200 people came in. And it's just a deep honor just to to get first place amongst this peer group, right? Because veterans, we are a community. We
hundreds of people applied, right?
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
And dozens made it to that final round and you wound up on top. So what is MPEC? Am I pronouncing it correct?
MPEC, yes.
MPEC. Yes, E-M-P-E-Q.
That's right. And unlike some of the other technologies that you guys have covered in the show, you know, and even earlier, you know, we don't blow things up. It's not a super exciting, you know, technology. However, we do stop things from blowing up, right? And so what we're focused on is really the equipment that runs our critical infrastructure. Right. It could be anything from planes and automobiles to the buildings that we you know, work and play within. Right. And so that is our hyper focus. Our passion is instant equipment insights, right? Helping the humans that are interacting with equipment at scale be able to have very deep information about that piece of equipment or its parts. Right. So we like to say we're connecting the equipment, you know, with the information you need so you can make better decisions faster. Right. And a great example, I guess, you know, to bring it home for all of us is we all have an appliance in our home. We've all had the light bulb go out in the refrigerator or in the oven or something. And it's not just the one you go to your basement or your attic and pull one out. You know, it's like the regular, you know, Edison bulb and plug it in. It's a special bulb. And in order to find out what that is, and it's typically the bulb is all burned off and you can't see anything. So you take down the make, model, and serial of the piece of, you know, refrigerator or whatever. And then you Google it, right? And you're like, that's not mine. That's mine. Okay, now I got to find out the part spec. And then, here's the light bulb. Okay, now I got to find out where the light bulb is, right? You copy, paste, and you go to maybe Amazon or eBay or, you know, hardware store or whatever, right? You just wasted 45 minutes to an hour of your life looking for
doing archaeology, I call it. We got to do the, like, archaeology of this water heater. I own multiple homes, I'm embarrassed to say, and I'm trying to sell them all so that I don't have to deal with so many water heaters in my life and then them blowing up. So I know
this dividing
problem.
Line you decided that the homes were too many because of the water heaters. I thought it was the property taxes.
There's the property taxes in California are not pretty, or Texas, I will say, but it's just a known problem. AI is positioned to be one of the biggest wealth creation events in history. That's my personal belief. That's why I'm working so hard to find great companies to invest in. I mean, experts predict AI could add over $15 trillion to the global economy by 2030. And you don't need to be an expert to know that AI is moving at a fast clip. Just open up all the different ChatGPT apps and look at how good they're getting. But there's a catch. Most of the AI revolution is being built and funded in private markets, meaning it's venture capitalists, not public market investors who are getting in early. Well, here's a game changer. The Fundrise Innovation Fund. It's a $125 million fund that gives individual investors like you a chance to own shares in some of the most exciting pre-IPO tech companies. And this includes some of the big names in AI. The Fundrise Innovation Fund pairs this with one of the lowest investment minimums the venture industry has ever seen, leveling the playing field for everyday investors. And we all know that a lot of the value is created in the private markets, not the public market. So get in early with the Fundrise Innovation Fund. Go to fundrise.com/twist to learn more. That's fundrise.com/twist. Carefully consider the investment material before investing, including objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. This and other information can be found in the Innovations Fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/innovation. This is a paid advertisement. And so you have people take out a smartphone, take pictures of all the equipment, and do a really quick or a fast site survey to kick this off. Now, this is not just for military people. This could be for any company, correct?
Yes, that is correct. We are B2B currently. We do have military customers. Our most notable is the Pentagon. Headquarters Air Force is actually a paying customer, so very proud of that. But yeah, I mean, if you picture this at scale, imagine your job being to look for light bulb types within refrigerators, and you're doing maybe operating with hundreds or thousands of pieces of equipment or parts as part of your job. And you're typically a six-figure engineer or field analyst or something, right? You're wasting a lot of time of just doing manual stuff. And 87%, this is a real number, 87% of the critical infrastructure marketplace that has men and women at scale working with parts and equipment every day, 87% is still using pen and an analog capture device like a paper or an NCR form or something.
Oh my today, Lord.
Today.
So, it's nuts. And now you have AI. So when you're taking pictures like this, you know, it's silly to say, but you're in these old legacy systems, somebody would write down the serial number, the model number, somebody would then type it into a legacy system or maybe into a Google sheet and have like a local inventory of stuff. It was a disaster. And now you have AI who reads the labels, does OCR and makes sense of it all. And you can do this at a fraction of the cost in a fraction of the time and just charge a SaaS fee per number of items, per number of users in the system. How do you price it?
That's a great question. So we went to market with a per seat pricing model. We're like, this is how everybody does SaaS, and this is what we're supposed to do, right? Get in line. And we start talking to big customers. I mean, our customers include Johnson Controls, Siemens, and many others worldwide. And, you know, they first out of the gate, like, yeah, we have a hard time with that. That's not really how we operate. We operate, you know, kind of more of a, cost, the COGS accounting model or cost of goods sold. Can you, you know, work with your pricing so it kind of fits into that? It makes sense to how we expend, right?
And so just charge us a license per year.
Yeah. And it's just, it's use as much as you want. Let the AI run as much as it needs to do its job for you. Mm-hmm. And it's highly scalable up and it's highly scalable down.
Herbert, does that impact your gross margins at all? Because I love the consumer or the customer like friendliness of an all you can eat price tag, but AI is famously expensive. So I'm curious if that does impact your overall gross margin profile.
You know, it's a great question. It actually, we did a case study on this and we looked at kind of doing it the traditional way and versus how much it actually costs to expand into an account, right? The salesperson has to not just sell the first license, has to keep selling all the licenses, right? And they kind of land and expand that. Where the other side of this is you just sell once and it's just, you know, whoever can come and eat, that's fine. But then we also looked at the actual cost of running the technology in the back end, and it actually, the margins increased to this new model.
So not only did you save money on your sales and marketing line item, but you also save money on gross margin.
Huh, right. And we also reduced the barrier of sales friction, right? Because we're aligned with how the customer wants to buy. right? Nice. Will this be how we're going to go to market for everybody? Eventually, no. We're going to have to work our way back and include some sort of traditional pricing model, just because we'll start to automate people to be able to get on the platform without a human being involved. And I think that we'll move in that general area, but right now, today, this is what's being
self-serve, people being able to pay like some entry fee for a certain amount of inventory, a certain number of users, you'll eventually get to. But starting with, big companies and whales, not a bad idea. Either of these strategies can work. What's most important is that you define an ideal customer profile, as we say in the business, an ICP, and say, hey, this is who we're going to go after first. And you have some rationale behind that. Hey, we're going to go after this group first because they desperately need a solution. They have a budget for the solution. They see the value in it. They're not so large that it's going to take 3 years to get through their process, but they're not so small that they don't need the product. And that's where, this great art of go-to market comes into play. Did you define an ICP yet? I know you're in early stages here, but is there an ICP that you've settled on, or do you have two or three you're experimenting with?
Yeah, we do have two or three that we're experimenting with in regards to field analysts, right? So again, this goes back to a male, female kind of field engineer type that is highly analytical, that's dealing with lots of pieces of equipment or parts as part of their job. And they need deep information about what they're looking at in front of them, right? The refrigerator or the car, or the sailboat, the counterfeit part, the electronic, part, the heating and cooling system. And they're there like, I know that's a chiller. I know that's a printed circuit board, but what is that black speck on there? Does that belong there? I don't know. Right. Take a picture. Yeah. Boom. Oh, it doesn't belong there. I'm glad I took a picture with MPEX technology because I almost put it in my airplane and put it into the sky.
Yeah. That is a whole other reason to use stuff like this, is to know the provenance, fancy way of saying where it came from, and making sure you don't have counterfeit parts. Amazing book, by the way, Alex, by Michael Crichton, called Airframe, which is about the counterfeit. It's basically, one of his great books. He got into like why planes fall out of the sky and found out that there's all these planes that are maintained suboptimally. And when you get to the developing world, formerly known as the third world, now called frontier markets and emerging markets, I think is the proper term. People might want to save money on parts, and they use third party, aka counterfeit parts.
Man, you're giving Spirit a lot of props here, and other discount carriers. I want to say, though, I'm not shocked that Herbert won this competition, because we have this little bit of information from him about his financial performance, Jason. And yeah. I believe that you would call this number tasty.
Yeah, 300% growth in 2024 to looks like $1.4 million in revenue is your estimate there. And so that means you're going to triple revenue year over year.
That's actually light. We just found out that we'll be over that this year.
Nice.
And so there is a term in SaaS or just in the industry, triple, 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 double, double, double. Basically, it means in the early stages, somebody starts with 100K in revenue. That first to second year, they get to 500K in revenue. Second to third year, 500 to 1.5, maybe two. Then they get to like six. And then it's harder to get from 6 to 18, obviously. It's a bigger number. And so maybe they go 6 to 12 or 6 to 14 or, even 6 to 10. Things slow down a little bit. They have to, maybe some growing pains here and there, headwinds, competitors, whatever it is. But you start to pattern match when you're going for the Series A. But you're a seed stage company. Total amount raised for the company is so far?
So 2.5 in equity and convertible debenture. We haven't had a VC round. That's what this pitch competition essentially kicked off, is a $4 million seed. But we have another $1 million in grant instruments, mostly from New York State, NYSERDA, New York State Research Energy Development Authority.
So 2.5 million to get to 1.4 million in revenue. It's pretty good use of capital so far. Yeah.
And then also, you said that you have a match, I think, with the formulating that you're raising. So it's actually 8. Is that correct, Herbert?
Yeah. So what's great about dual use companies, right? And these are companies that serve a commercial purpose and a military purpose. I can tell you the military wants that. They don't want the startup to be fully reliant on military funding, because it's like watching paint dry sometimes. So with that being said, there are programs within the federal government that enable you to accelerate and provide typically a one-to-one match for highly targeted technologies. So we have right now two programs that we'll be applying to early part of 2025 that is a one-to-one match on that $4 million equity. So for every dollar we raise in equity, up to $4 million, we'll get up to $4 million match from two programs in the federal government.
Amazing.
Awesome.
Well, listen, this has been great. What's the website if people want to go learn more about your solution, Herbert?
MPEQ.co, MPEQ.co.
Got it. I'm assuming you're Herbert at MPEQ.co.
Yes, I am.
Perfect. Right. Mike, if people want to learn more about the Veteran Fund, either potentially as an LP down the road, I'm not sure if the fund's open or not, nor do I want you to say because you'll be soliciting. So if they wanted to potentially participate as an LP down the road, I'll frame it like that. Or if they were seeking funding, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, thanks, Jacob. We'll be back to market next year. So not fundraising, not general solicitation. And we'll go out we're targeting 100 cap on that one. Simple, veteran.fund, Mike at veteran.fund, super easy. And one quick thing, Jason, I'll say is it was a 100K pitch comp that we did, but because of Herbert and MPEQ, we were really impressed. First of all, we'd love to co-invest with you on this. We're bumping our investment up. It'll be a 250 minimum, probably closer to 300. And what Herbert just said is a very important takeaway, I think, for all founders and investors listening to this, is this whole dual-use technology. We love companies that have strong commercial traction like Herbert's and then go out and get the government as a customer. They lock in that non-dilutive capital in the form of SBIR and SITRs, and then they get fund matching through TACFI, StratFi, SBIR and other vehicles. SBIR and
SITRs, just define those real quick.
SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research. It's essentially R&D and product development, non-dilutive funding the government provides. Amazing. They have billions of dollars available to companies to get into the government.
Amazing. All right, well done. And we'll drop you guys off and we'll see you next time. Keep us informed of your progress. And I look forward to the next pitch competition.
And thanks so much, my brother. Mike. Go Army. All right, thanks, guys.
Oh, God. It's got some Marines on here.
Hoorah.
Simplify, boys. Hoorah.
Appreciate it.
Simplify, boys.
Hoorah.
Okay.
Bye, guys. I have to get in the Army, the Army elbow
absolutely.
In there. It's got to do it for the family.
All right. Take a second and picture the ultimate all-star team for your startup. Okay, you got that mental image? Maybe the Avengers, maybe even X-Men, Wolverine, Cyclops, pick your favorite superhero team. And let's be realistic. Until you've raised your Series A or your Series B, you might need some help building that dream team and finding top-tier talent, managing all the timelines you've got and maintaining quality. It's a big lift for all founders. I mean, scouting for that elusive 10x developer, that's going to eat all your time. And that's where Dev Squad comes in. Think of them as like Professor X, you know, they know where to find those exceptional mutant developers who are 10x devs. And Dev Squad offers a complete product team from Latin America. You're going to get 2 to 6 full stack developers, a technical product manager, and specialists in case you need them, like product strategy or UI and UX design, DevOps, and of course, quality assurance. All for 75% less than a US-based team. All for 75% less than a US-based team while being on your same time zone, which is really important. There's no long-term commitment. It's just seamless collaboration. So if you want a GSD, if you want to get stuff done and you're ready to squad up, head to devsquad.com/twist for 10% off your first engagement. That's devsquad.com/twist and transform your startup with the all-star team it deserves. Alex, I just wanted to also inform the audience that we're doing our launch Cloud Kitchens Incubator again. All of you know, my friend Diego and Travis, formerly of Uber, created Cloud Kitchens, and they are doing an incubator with us. It's a 14-week program for food and tech entrepreneurs. If you want to break into the ghost kitchen space and you think that you can create the next great food brand, this is the way to do it. If you know, Alex, a lot of people will start by doing a pop-up or being like a chef for people, maybe doing parties, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you build up to like maybe a food truck, and a food truck that might cost you, like, you know, and setting up your own catering business, it might cost you $0, might cost you $10,000.
Sure.
Setting up a food truck and going into business there, it's like low hundreds of thousands of dollars. Setting up a restaurant, or like, let's say you had a really cheap storefront, like I think a minimum $1 million, $2 million, yeah. Proper restaurant, you know, you start getting to $3-5 million investment. And the problem with that is you don't know if it's going to work or not, right? There's no MVP of restaurants.
No.
Well, now there is. called a ghost kitchen. When you get a ghost kitchen, and we're investors in cloud kitchens, our fund is, it's like a cloud kitchen costs you low thousands of dollars a month, and you're up and running, and you're plugged into immediately an incredibly high volume infrastructure called food delivery, Uber Eats, DoorDash, etc. So the cloud kitchens are run, to make food for those. And what we're doing in this accelerator and incubator is just getting you plugged into all that, starting you on third base, kitchen economics, the operations, how to do marketing and branding inside of these apps. It's completely different than doing a restaurant.
That's actually a really good point. It's an entirely different marketing space. Yeah.
Totally different. Should you pay for ads on Uber Eats and DoorDash to move up in the rankings? What market should you launch in? What should you be your second and third market? There's a big issue. Like, hey, if you're got something great out in Brooklyn, is your next best idea to be further into Brooklyn? Mm-hmm. Brooklyn's a pretty big place. Or to go to Queens and Manhattan? Or is it to go to Philly and Boston or Rhode Island? How do you deploy that second, third, fourth, cloud kitchen? And that's the magic of, I think, this new space. Also, delivery food is different than in a restaurant. You can do a souffle in a restaurant. You can do a little ice cream tasting. Can you do ice cream and souffle, delivery? I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe you can figure it out.
If you can figure that out, if you can bring me a souffle delivered, that's actually good. My God. I'll give you money.
But there, I can tell you, I know boba and ice cream is getting delivered, and it's getting delivered in a certain way, a certain radius. So anyway, these are all the technical things. We're on our second class. We had great companies come to the first. It's an experiment. I like to do little experiments. You can apply at ck.launch.co. We put money into each company. We have a little fund, a micro fund. It's like $1 million or $2 million fund. And we give a little bit of money, a bunch of mentorship, a bunch of networking. So if you want to come to LIC, the Launch Cloud Kitchens Incubator, see that? We took the letters, LCKI, and we just call it LIC internally. Go to ck.launch.co.
I love that. And I'm just going to say it again. I've been watching a new bakery / coffee shop open a couple blocks from where I live, keeping it slightly vague. And I met the owner and the proprietor and the entrepreneur behind it before they opened. And I was just so hoping that the care and the effort that Waleed put into this place was going to get paid off. And now every time I go there, there's a line out the door. And I'm like, how dare you guys eat my croissants that I was going to eat? Get out. I live here. Anyways, but there was no MVP to your point. So when he built this place, Brown Bee Coffee, he didn't know. It was literally a gamble with, I think,
his life savings. Right?
Yes. Brutal.
You're tough. Basically, and then if it doesn't work out, hey, you got to go, maybe you got to go drive Uber Eats and DoorDash to pay for the bills. And there's all this modern technology stack. I've learned a lot there. You can use like Uber Eats drivers or Uber drivers or even DoorDash drivers as like an API service. So a lot of these folks are trying to convert you to directly going to their website, directly ordering from them to get rid of the fees that Uber Eats or DoorDash charge. So there's a whole bunch of ideas here about how do you build direct relationships with your top customers? What are high margin things that you can include in it? So, I've been brainstorming with folks. I'm like, how come you don't have like anything for the whale in the system? I'm always wondering, like, where's the Peking duck? Where's the, ribeye for two? You should have a $100 item every menu. And when's the last time you saw a $100 item on a to-go menu?
Well, never, but I have paid what feels like $100 to have a burrito brought to my house.
Precisely. Exactly. And so you should be thinking about that. And I was talking to one of the companies. I was like, this is really great. It'd be great for breakfast the next day. Like, when you sell in, why don't you put kids, because I was literally ordering, and I was like, why don't you offer something for the kids' school lunch or breakfast the next day? When you get into the private chef space, a lot of what private chefs do is they serve you dinner one night, as you know, Alex, and then they will prepare for you breakfast for the next 2 days, lunch for the kids for the next 3 days, and then maybe a dinner you cook yourself tomorrow. They put the salmon in the tray and let you bake it. So a lot of these
I don't know private
chef services do that. Yeah.
I do not have private chef money. I have used those. There's a local meal service that does something very similar that essentially it was a one or two woman shop, and they would, you would or sign up for some number of meals per week, and they would pre-make like half of it, and then you kind of finish it. And we loved that. But then our kids just were more picky than what the offerings were supposed to be to drop it. But I would love to have a private chef. What do those cost?
There was just a story on it in Silicon Valley. In Silicon Valley, it's 150 to 300K a year all in comp for the chefs. And there is a big competition amongst elite people to be able to say, my chef previously worked at X, Y, and Z. Or Z. And so I have been to people's homes and hey, this person, you know, worked at Quince, this person worked at this Michelin star place, whatever it is. And it's a little bit of bragging, right? It's like a little fancy, like, oh yes, our chef at home worked at Quince, you know, a Michelin star place in the city. So, and then, you know, food on top of that, obviously. So, you know, you would be talking about spending $1,000 a day, basically, on something like this. I mean, it is rarefied air. It's 1% or territory. But there are other ones that are doing what you're sort of talking about, or the one I'm talking about. So here in Austin, I was looking at it because I have some friends who have it who are affluent, but not 0.01% is with like, and don't want a full-time chef. And those services, and I've looked at these because there's like marketplaces that have tried to come out to do this. And I think there might be a marketplace business for it of, hey, you pay $500 for a chef to come for a day, plus the cost of the food, let's say $300. So for $800, they make the meals for 4 days. So they serve you dinner that night, but they come early, they stay a little bit later. So you get like this nice, you know, Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night meal, but then they prepare for you. Hey, you got two kids, here's their breakfast for the next couple of days. You know, we like to make these egg bites that you get at Starbucks. We make those at the house because we all love them. And so we'll make those in advance. When I say we, I mean, my wife and I will make them. And those are great, you know, grab and go kind of options. And they'll do that kind of thing, right? Or maybe make lunches or maybe make two dinners for you. And, you know, here's your salmon with pesto on it. Here's your baked lasagna. You know, pop it in the oven, easy breezy. So there's a lot of opportunities there. And I think this could be a very interesting business. What I love about the Cloud Kitchens model is, you know, you can do these with two people. And you can pop it up for 25K or less. If you lose the 25K, it's not the end of the world. And if you lose our 25 or 50K, it's certainly not the end of the world. You got to take a shot. And so my advice is, if you are somebody working at a kitchen, maybe you're a sous chef, maybe you work in the front of the house, or maybe you and your friend work front and back of the house, and you got an idea, you know, hey, these three menu items are really killer. We should make a Caesar salad branded restaurant. And we're just going to do Caesar salads. Yeah, but it's Caesar salad with three or four different things on it. It's like, you know, Caesar's Palace. make some pun about Caesar Salad Palace. Caesar Salad Palace. Actually, that's pretty good. Can you imagine? And this is the kind of riffing you can do. Caesar Salad Palace would be a great idea. You know, everybody loves good Caesar. And you have three or four different options there. You have two or three different types of anchovies. You got two, and you can get a Caesar wrap. You'd have it as a wrap. You'd have it as a salad. You can get a Caesar burger. Maybe there's all kinds of like interesting things you can do in that space, and people might want to try it. There you go.
People don't try to pitch that now for the incubator, I'm going to be really disappointed. And by the way, if you do make Caesar Salad Palace, we'll have you on the show.
What's your idea, Alex? Give me your best idea. What's your favorite dish of the moment? What's something you keep going back to? What's your favorite dish? Let's do a little riff right here.
I'm not going to lie. It's not as adventurous as I wish it was to share on the show, okay. But it's a sandwich called the Vermonster. There's a place near where I live called Amy's. It's open 5 days a week. And the Vermonster is a wrap that has sausage and scrambled eggs in it. It's kind of like a breakfast burrito, but critically, it has this maple aioli that goes through it. And so it's like hot, mapley, sweet, but salty. It's the best breakfast thing I've ever eaten. And I've purchased hundreds of them.
The breakfast wrap shop. There we go.
Dude.
And so, you know, doing a wrap shop is such a good idea, and making it 24 hours a day, because I bet you would eat that for lunch.
Oh, yeah.
And I love a breakfast all day. When I see breakfast all day on the menu, I'm like a French person. You know, they like to have an omelet at dinner sometimes. You ever see that? Go to a bistro and they're like, you go to Balthazar, they still got the $18 omelet on the menu. I love that. I'm more than willing to have an omelet for dinner. I think it's quite sophisticated. So this could be like a really good one. The breakfast wrap shop, 24 hours a day. absolutely fantastic idea.
Why do we do This Week in Startups when we could just pivot the whole brand and do This Week in Food?
This Week in Food. We just talk about food the whole show. So anyway, if you got great ideas, ck.launch.co, or if you go to launch.co, it should be in the menu, ck.launch.co. So let's talk about the Twist 500, the top 500 private companies in a database selected editorially by our research team and talked about here on the podcast every episode.
Yes.
That's what we're doing. We've got 100 of them or so, and we're trying to get to 250 by the end of the year.
Yep.
Go to twist500.com to see this database. The idea is, people always ask me, what are the top private companies after SpaceX and Stripe and all the ones, you know, that aren't public yet? And we want to help people sort that. And so we are slowly but surely getting there.
Yes. And Jason tasked us with putting together a neat little graphic to show off today's company that we're going to add. And Jason, this is a company that I would have sworn we had on, but I had not added. And so I want everyone to say hello to our dear friends over at everyone's favorite emoji-based startup, Hugging Face. Jason, really brief, just in a couple of words. It hosts AI models, it sells some AI compute, and also hosts AI community. So it's a bit more than just a repository. And on the business model front, two-part, mostly it's SaaS. They also do have some on-demand compute, but I wasn't able to figure out from the outside how much of that their business is predicated on that. But certainly amongst the AI companies, this is one that I think has probably top five mind share out there today.
A lot of people are talking about Hugging Face because if you want to track what's happening on going on in the AI open source model with open source models, you just go there and you can actually use them. You can fire up instances of them. And it's backed by Lux Capital. Josh, shout out to Josh. Betaworks, my friend John Borthwick. Salesforce Ventures, I guess, has gotten in there in addition. I'm not sure which firm that is. I may know them.
Salesforce Ventures led one of the later rounds, according to Crunchbase, so I threw them in. But Lux Capital has, if memory serves, led several different rounds in this company. Wow. So if Hugging Face does well, Josh will be able to afford his own private chef in New York. But
they've raised $395 million. That's a big number.
That's a lot of money. I think that goes to show, Jason, how active the AI market is in a positive sense, because this is not a foundation model company. This is not a neo cloud. This is something that sits in between them, but has become the GitHub of AI, I want to say.
Yes. And GitHub obviously has their own hosted AI models, and GitHub was purchased by Microsoft, right? It's owned by Microsoft. It was a really savvy move because Microsoft loves developers. You could throw in the graphic of Steve Ballmer clapping and yelling, developers in post, if you don't know that meme. And the other competitor is Kaggle, obviously, K-A-G-G-L-E, which we should put into the Twist 500 if they pass the bar, and then we would have them in the database as competitors. So we should, in the database, I don't know if we have competitors as a field, but let's make a note to add that to the field. Hugging Face, welcome to the Twist 500. We're going to do a series of events next year, by the way, Twist 500. Just so Alex and I can do live events together. So we will be booking like a day for the robotics companies here in Austin or maybe Boston, wherever like some of the top ones are. And it's not going to really have an agenda. I'm not really doing it to make money. I'm doing it because I'm passionate about tech. It'll make great content and I'll get to meet all these amazing founders in a very efficient fashion. They get to meet each other.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think of a format for an event. I was thinking of having, I usually like single track events. I was thinking of maybe making this a multi-track event where there's maybe five tracks going on in five rooms. Each room has 100, 200 seats, something like that. And then one track for SaaS, one track for robotics, one for AI, one for marketplaces, et cetera, fintech and consumer. And my idea is 30 minutes. You just pitch your company as best you can for 15, 20 minutes. You take two or three questions from the audience.
Yeah.
And then you got a nice, like, hey, here's our company. Here's why it exists. And then at the end, you know, those groups get to all hang out together and have dinner.
Well,
pretty simple format, right? So we just have 10 of them. What would you do if you did 9 to 12 and then 2 to 5 is 3 plus 3 hours. So 6 hours, half hour each.
12 per day 12 per
companies,
stage.
Yeah, 12 per day per stage, maybe five stages. You get 60 companies a day. You do it for 2 days, you get 120. So you get one out of four.
Yeah.
Well, pretty cool event.
I think it'd be a lot of fun, especially because what I've learned about how you host events is that there's usually a poker table within about a 1 mile radius of the event. And so that means I can go collect venture capital money via third parties.
I staked you the last time.
No, you didn't.
I didn't stake you?
No.
I offered to stake you. How did you do? Did you wind up up or down? Be honest.
I was up like 150 or something, relatively modest.
All right, that's fine.
Yeah. But no, I mean, the reason why I played the lowest stakes is I'm out of shape. My poker game has fallen off because I have small children. I do want to add one more thing to the Hugging Face, because I was looking into them today. I've known them. We all follow each other on Twitter. Great company. I use it. Love it. But I didn't know that it actually started off as a chatbot. And then they open sourced.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, they open sourced their own model. And then they began to open source more models. And then it kind of grew from there. But I love seeing people come together, build something, notice something else, and then go hard into it. And I
give this speech to people. It's so interesting that you have this observation. It's not necessarily a pivot. What I call it is keeping your peripheral vision open. So when I have a talk with founders, like, hey, you want to have blinders on, you're staying super focused, you got your ideal customer profile, as we've talked about with countless founders. You know, you're really trying to solve an acute problem, as Paul Graham would call a hair on fire problem for people. That's what these companies do, you know, startups. You build the best team you can to build a product that solves a really hard problem for customers. If you do that, things tend to work out. If you break that model, not a great team, not a great product that doesn't solve a problem, you're going to have problems. So keep your peripheral vision open. And sometimes you're like on an adventure and you see something off the side. Christopher Columbus comes to mind. I always talk about Christopher Columbus going, you know, trying to find a new route to, you know, the new spice route or whatever he was looking for, a new way to get spices. And he wound up hitting North America. Here we go. Boom. So keep your peripheral vision open. Hugging Face did it. Let's get the founder of Hugging Face on the show here. We should have him on This Week in Startups. And this would be, I think, the next piece of this Twist 500 is we announce them, we walk through it, boom, then we have them on.
So I'm currently trying to get Clem to come on because he dropped some very interesting 2025 AI predictions, and then he graded his 2024 predictions. I love the public accountability there, saying he got right and wrong. And he was mostly right. So I think he's probably the person to talk to at the end of the year as we look forward. So that is on the list. If Hogan Face PR team, if you see this, I have emailed you, so please hit me back. And Jason, to close us out today, can I show you something that I think you're going to find very interesting? Because I want to talk about Europe again. This is one of something I've been thinking a lot about. Did you see the report that came out in September from the EU about why its economy isn't growing as much? It was the Draghi report.
I didn't, but it's no news, having been in technology and business since the early 90s, which means I've been doing it for 30 years.
Yep.
I have been meeting founders in Europe all the time, and I hear them complaining, lamenting rules, regs, and even like a culture that doesn't celebrate entrepreneurship, dare I say, reckless entrepreneurship at its best.
Yeah.
Risk-taking, reckless abandon, pursuing your dream. It's looked at differently there. And that's actually been part of the complaint too, is that you just feel unsupported. You feel like people look down on you. As opposed to America, they come to America and they're like, I told everybody I have a startup. They all give me a high five. I tell them when I'm in France or Europe, Germany, wherever, I have a startup. People look at me and they think I'm trying to pull one over on people. I'm running a racket.
Well, the report highlighted a result of what you're describing, which is that, and I'm quoting from a speech about the report. In fact, there is no EU company with a market capitalization of over 100 billion euros that has been set up from scratch in the last 50 years. All six US companies with valuations above 1 trillion euros have been created in that time period. And that is indicative of the gap. But that's old news. People have talked about that. What's new is that a guy from MIT, Andrew McAfee, took the same idea, Jason. He said, what if we lowered the threshold to $10 billion? Not $100 billion.
Okay, decacorn as opposed to a centurion. Got it.
And these would be public from scratch US and EU companies. So they have to make it through the threshold. But here is what.
Well, so you have Klarna, you have Spotify, you have Clash of Clans. I'm wondering if any of these, I know obviously Spotify went way past the $10 billion mark.
Yeah.
But I mean, we're this is a wide window. This is since the 70s or 80s?
This is 50 years. So SAP, a multi-hundred billion dollar company, is actually 52 years old. So it just missed this chart. But this is on screen a look at the different companies and their relative market caps by bubble size.
And so we see a lot of green bubbles, the giant ones being the Magnificent Seven, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Nvidia, et cetera, Meta, and that's wild. You see the EU. This is interesting. Wow. Yeah, so what are the purples? The purples are the 10 billion?
The purples are the other companies. Oh, so green is companies. Tech, blue is just like, you know, Blackstone, Home Depot, Uber.
So we're living in a tech world. So what are the two or three largest blue circles in America? I'm curious.
Tesla, United Health, T-Mobile, Costco, Vertex.
Wait a second. I would consider Tesla and T-Mobile tech. Yeah. So, I mean, this speaks to a number of things. American exceptionalism being the primary one. And, you know, the culture of American exceptionalism. We are a young country. We're a hungry country. I think other countries maybe are not as hungry because they're older. And when I meet families there, they may be into the country, the culture, might be into capital preservation. And so when I was talking to some of the people from Italy trying to do economic development there, or England or France, they would often tell me that the differences, this is not my opinion, this is what was told to me, is that, you know, families that own businesses there do not participate, the legacy companies, let's say, the old money does not participate in things like venture capital. Now, when I came here to Texas and I was talking to a bunch of venture capitalists and people who run SPVs here, they were telling me the oil money, the old money here, loves to get in on tech deals, loves to do an SPV, loves to drop $500,000, $1 million, $5 million into some new technology. I'm like, who are these people? Like, they don't want you to know who they are. Nobody knows who they are. They're just rich people, and they really want to get in on the action. And that is another part of it. So the high order bit for me is, you know, the American exceptionalism, a young country. But then there's also capital formation and capital markets and regulation. And here, we talk about regulation all the time. We talked about the wrath of Lena Khan for the last 4 years. We talk about accredited investor regulations. And in this show, we talked about Gary Gensler not creating a path forward, getting fired, essentially. Getting a lot of, you know, criticism. Some of it's rightful, some of it's not. And, you know, us saying, you know what, let's replace him. And I don't know what you think, but here's my question for you. What percentage of young men coming out for Trump do you think could have had to do with the pro-crypto stance? And then what percentage of the money he raised came from pro crypto, you know, individuals? Because crypto is not a niche anymore in America or South Korea. There's a large contingent of people, low double digit percentage, who are either holders or fans of this. It's not niche anymore. So when you look at the election and getting to Denmark, two questions: what percentage of the voting populace do you think might have voted with that as one of their top issues? Not the top, but it could be the top issues. And then what percentage of the money you think sloshing around is crypto related?
Well, the second one's larger than the first. If you look at, you know, that number compared to the whole, I don't think the number of people whose votes changed strictly due to crypto was that large in terms of a percentage of the electorate, but in the U.S., where Trump won by about 1.7%, whatever the latest number is of the vote tally, a couple of points is a lot. And that's why I think people talk a lot about this. Now, on the money side, I forget her name. Is it Molly White? Ran a very interesting site looking through all the crypto packs and so forth. And the answer was hundreds of millions of dollars, if I recall correctly. And so I think that what crypto did was they decided that they were going to get very involved. They backed, if I recall, several hundred different candidates, mostly Republicans, some Democrats, and they made this an issue that they then won. I mean, we started off the show with the new head of the SEC, who is very much aligned with the crypto industry. They absolutely won. So I think it was a couple of points. It was a whole hell of a lot of money, but the ROI, Jason, on every dollar that was spent in these crypto super PACs, I believe is going to be very high, probably higher than investing in venture funds investing in crypto.
Yeah. I mean, it was a 3% win for Trump. He had 3% more of the overall voting electorate, I believe. This is about 150 million votes. He won by 2.5 million. 2.5 million is roughly 2-3% of the overall voting. So if 1% of those were crypto, you know, now you're down to a 1%, you know, coin toss as opposed to a 2.5 clear victory. So what was the Jervison tweet? Did he have a similar observation to me?
Bring it back up. Jervison pointed out
that Europe's tiny balls. Yeah, well done, Steve.
I thought you were going to like that. He says that he agrees with you that Tesla should be scooted into the green category. The reason why I wanted to bring up Jervison is not that his view is agreeing with you that Tesla is a tech company versus a non-tech company, but it was this stat right here. Okay. When we look at companies that are born from scratch and went public and now are worth more than $10 billion in the US versus the EU, the US wins by 70x. And that is bad for Europe. It's not good for their economy, their dynamism, their ability to, you know, compete with China. Like, a bunch of people that we are nationally, politically, and militarily aligned with are really struggling financially. And
here's what you can take from this.
Okay.
If you are, I'm just going to, may I be based Cal? Can based Cal come out for a moment?
All right, let's do it.
Okay. It's a based Cal. Socialism is garbage. Capitalism plus democracy is the best operating system humanity has ever come out with to date. It's flawed. It's got all kinds of criticisms you can make. Socialism is the road to communism, is the road to slow economic growth. And so we get to pick as human beings on planet Earth, in some cases, if you want to live in which of these pros and cons. When you and I look at this, capitalism, democracy, as Americans, we go, well, of course you want to live in the country that is at war with itself, is fighting, it's messy, it's sloppy, this election, the last election, the election before that, and every election before that. It's a mess here. It feels crazy. But the economy keeps beating everything else out there. Why? Because we believe in the fundamental tenet of competition, and that running from competition is a mistake, and running towards competition is great. Now, in competition, you have winners and losers. And when you have a vibrant competition that is rabid, I think I said reckless before, you know, that you can pursue with reckless abandon. And I brought it up when we interviewed our veterans on today's show. And so, and I'm not sure where that's going to be placed here, but I did talk about, hey, did the military folks, do they have that like sort of improvising, bend the rules kind of thing? If you want to have big outcomes, you need to support crazy, vibrant competition. If you want everybody to live in a tighter strata, what you're asking for is socialism. And then, you know, socialism sometimes leads to communism, there's dictatorships, and then, you know what we have in a vibrant capitalist society? You have people buying elections. You have people using money as influence. You have these other set of problems that we have to contend with here, where these super PACs, as we're talking about with crypto, could have bought, quote unquote, bought 1-2% electorate. Is that a problem? It feels unfair in some ways, but in some ways it feels very fair because they have collectively said, we're going to place our resources, AKA money, on influencing our government to make rules that go in favor of more innovation. Could it go the other way and the rich get richer? Yes, the rich get richer in a competition. That's how it works. The high performers get more money. What do you think happens with actors? You think George Clooney and Brad Pitt get paid less than people who aren't as good looking and aren't as good at acting and don't sell as many tickets? Of course not. Robert Downey Jr. sells tickets. That's why they brought him back as Dr. Doom, a villain. Like, Marvel was struggling. They brought back the highest performer, Robert Downey Jr. It's a competition. He gets paid more than the 10,000 extras who were in those films. Is it fair? I don't know what fair means. All I know is that kid sells a lot of tickets. That's it. pick your poison. And if you want healthcare that's, you know, and you want to live in a tighter strata and you want the entry level job and the highest level job to be in a tighter strata and, you know, the difference between a CEO comp and the, you know, entry level comp to be tighter, you can do that. Go to Europe and you'll have a bunch of small balls. And if you want the big balls, you come to America. Yeah, base cow.
I just want, okay, so I have a section from the report actually that underscores what you were saying, but I just want to take a moment while we're here, kind of back half of the show, kind of loose zone. How do you define socialism? Because it's one of those words that I feel like has a lot of, everyone has their own pet definition. So when you start off with socialism sucks.
Yes.
What are you referring to in that nugget?
And it's a spectrum. So when people say socialism, they would say the redistribution of wealth, people taking care of each other, the highest performers in the society paying a bunch of taxes that then get redistributed through products and services for the rest of the folks in that country. And communism, we obviously know what that is. You know, it's a dictatorship where they decide the winners and losers. Socialism, you kind of throttle the winners and losers. You mute the winners and losers in favor of taking care of more people and more people sharing in the bounty of the big balls, thus shriveling the balls and making smaller balls. Now, I actually believe in universal healthcare. So am I a socialist? I think I am a pragmatist. I believe capitalism, freewheeling capitalism, as long as you're not breaking the laws and the rules. That's what I believe in. And on the margins, I kind of like people who reinterpret the rules and fight to change the rules in real time. So I admire that about crypto people. I admire that about Airbnb, about Uber, about the full self-driving movement. I like they're putting pressure on it. They're trying things. Now, don't kill anybody. I don't want to see it be like Theranos where people's lives are at stakes and you're incompetent, right? So if you want to bend rules and break rules, you got to be competent. My point is socialism, you know, and trying to have equal outcomes, I think is how a lot of people would say it is. Everybody benefits. Everybody gets a more similar outcome. It doesn't result in big, huge balls. And big, huge balls throw off so much tax that the standard of living here tends to be better than most places. And the opportunity here is certainly better. So again, people in socialist countries and the rabid democracy that's America can move between them. You can leave one and come to the other, which all the Europeans do to come here. All the entrepreneurs come here. And you know what people say? You're smart. So what I say to socialists, I have friends who are very socialist and they want universal healthcare and they want nobody should be able to make over $1 billion, right? That's like a real socialist concept. Bernie saying, like, why do we even have Lisbon? Why do we have billionaires? Why should people be able to acquire this much wealth? You know what? I have an idea. Move to France. Enjoy it. Enjoy paying 55% tax, 60% tax, whatever the Nordics, some of them have on the margins, these crazy tax laws. We had somebody on recently. Anyway, that's my rant.
So
what do you think?
Well, I think your definition of socialism is slightly squishy because what counts as redistribution for one person is probably not for another. And so, and this is why I wanted to get your explanation of it, because I presume that your views on what socialism is are shared amongst other folks in technology. Do you think your definition of socialism is typical or atypical for people in tech?
I think it's pretty typical. Okay. I mean, classically, you know, I'm just looking at the definition from ChatGPT. Socialism is a political economic system where the means of production, distribution, and exchange are owned by or regulated collectively by the community or the state.
Yeah, democratic control of the commanding heights has always been how I've defined socialism as compared to capitalism. I think that what you're describing is more like just welfare-y capitalism. And I think we've diluted
social
the term
democracy.
Socialism to the point in which people are not using it correctly. Like communism, you phrased as dictatorship when actually it's the abolition of private property. Socialism is collective ownership of certain elements of the economy, which, by the way, not in favor of. But I think that when we make socialism anything that's to the left of Ted Cruz, in terms of how we spend our national resources, we don't give ourselves enough space to be creative with our collective pot and get to things like you and I both agree on, which is decoupling healthcare from employment.
Which is, you know, that's the pragmatism I look at. Now, the reason I don't want to give capital, I don't want to give healthcare to the government right now is the government's so incompetent. So I almost feel like the free market would do better. And you're starting to see it. Urgent care and paying for doctors virtually post-COVID is how a lot of people are rolling their own healthcare. I know rich people who roll their own healthcare now. They pay out of pocket for everything, and they have like an umbrella policy where like the first 50K they pay, and over 50, they have like a, what do they call that? Like
high, safety net? High deductible plan, essentially?
Yeah, like an absurdly high deductible. It's a catastrophic plan.
So yeah,
oh my God, you know, you had $1 million, $2 million, $3 million in healthcare. So you pay the first 50 and you have this catastrophic, you know, God forbid something terrible has happened. But my Lord, you know, we need to, and healthcare is just a huge discussion, but I feel like the government should try to provide some services extremely affordably for free.
Okay.
And that would require some private partnership, private-public partnership with competent people in the government grinding down multiple vendors to get the right cost, which we're starting to see with the military. So if the military can do that, why can't we do that with, I don't know, like, what is the proper amount you should pay have your blood work done? What is the proper amount you should pay for a torn meniscus? And when you start to have a global marketplace for these things, you see people going and getting their plastic surgery in South Korea, Mexico, in Europe. So now there's this whole plastic surgery tourism because people have to pay out of pocket. The free market does it. So I kind of feel like more free market solutions would be good. And I think Pronovo and some of those new urgent care is one, you know, like you pay out of your pocket, but you get better service 24 hours a day. And then people are going to Hims or Hers and getting certain prescriptions or dollar cost, you know, Mark Cubans, and they're rolling their own healthcare, paying for their own pills out of pocket because it's better than using an insurance company.
Yeah. I just remember I didn't have to pay it, but when I got out of rehab, my I was part of Kaiser in California, that kind of like vertical health group. And they sent me a bill of like what they counted internally as the costs associated with my hospital stay. And then a week or two in outpatient rehab, and it was some ungodly figure. Like, it was so large, I was giggling. I paid like $200 because I was insured. But I don't think kindness from the collective pot constitutes socialism. And that's kind of the point I wanted to make, is that I think we do a lot of things together. For example, we spend a lot of money on the military and we share it around the world, you know? So
roads, schools, bridges, and there's some things that we provide.
You know, there's some things we do together. I don't think having public water utilities counts as socialism. But if we did have, for example, all aircraft manufacturing under the government, that would be different. So that's
that'd be socialist.
That's my take. I think you can be a capitalist society with a safety net and not be stuck in the European malaise. I think that is a possible
thing.
How
many people should the safety net catch? If you had to pick a number, what percentage of society?
Answer me this first. What percent of people in the US does the safety net currently catch?
I think it's like 50, 60 million people. Yeah.
Because I think Medicare and Medicaid, like 150 million people are on those.
Oh, I don't know if I was counting that. I was counting more like how many people are on welfare.
SNAP and so forth. Yeah.
Et cetera in the USA.
Yeah. I'm curious.
I thought that was like 50, 60 million. But also there's households, so maybe numbers could be wrong, but Social Security, 68 million.
Yeah.
20% of the population. Supplemental nutrition, SNAP, 42 million, 12%. Medicaid, 23%. So, temporary. So, yeah. I mean, there's overlap, obviously.
That's the struggle. So, call it 35% just for the sake of conversation.
Yeah.
So
one in three. Yeah.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. So that's a very high number.
Well, I mean, there's
that speaks to something. Yeah.
You know, I don't know how to phrase this. Cause I said something rude about everyday people on the show about 2 months ago, and people called me out for it, and I had to tidy that up. So I'm gonna just be as kind as I can. Jason, you and I look at the world through the lens of our experiences, our education, and our intellect. Yes. Not everyone has as much to pull from in those areas. And I'm sympathetic to people who struggle in a very competitive, fast-paced society, because not everyone is born with the same capabilities. And I think everyone should still eat. If that makes me a socialist, bring it on.
There is something to be said for what RFK said about, hey, you know, if we could actually provide healthy food for everybody for what we're spending right now. And so as much as some people find him to be like a loon, or, you know, they make him anti-vax, whatever, you know, I think he does have some insights there about, if we were starting from a zero-based budget and we said we wanted everybody to be healthy, what would we do? You know, we might all come to the conclusion that clean drinking water would be on that list, and maybe vegetables and kids' lunches, healthy lunches would be on the list, and we would be okay with it.
Michelle Obama was talking about this 10 years ago, and everyone was so mean to her about this. She was like, kids should have broccoli, and everyone was like, boo, hiss, eat Doritos. And now that Trump's doing it, everyone's, oh my God, we have to make America healthy again.
Make America healthy the again.
Cognitive dissonance, Jason, Cal, Candace, not with you, but everyone else, drives me. My blood pressure goes up.
That's because Trump is a populist, not a Republican. He's not a conservative.
Yeah.
He's a populist.
You know,
and you know what the two populist positions are? Getting skinny, being healthy, closing the border, and crypto. These are populist positions. Those are incredibly populist.
Who did you see the picture of him on his plane when he made RFK pose the Big Mac, and RFK was looking at it like it was an alien turd?
Yes.
I wonder if he actually ate any of that. But
here's my advice. Okay. Once a week. If you want to do fast food once a week, your body will be fine with it. Just don't make it twice a day. I don't think it's healthy twice a day.
No. I eat trash, but I also eat healthy and exercise. But like, you will never get me to stop eating Nerds, for example. Like, I will die with a half box of Nerds.
There's
in my
a Chewy Nerds. My daughter's got me on these Chewy Nerds at the movie theater. It's quite nice. All right, everybody. This has been another amazing episode. He's at alexx.com/Alex. We're into rambling territory now. X.com/Jason. We do this 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, sometimes four. Who knows? And subscribe to the show. And when you come into the you can watch the show live and you get about 20% more show. If you want 20% more show, go to YouTube or X and follow the show account and put alerts on. You get a thing when the alerts come on and we read your name. We say hi to you. The first like 20 people who come in, we say Noti Gang. Noti Gang is the notification gang. So turn your notifications on for YouTube. It's a lot of fun to talk to the live audience. We'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.